Welcome, everybody. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush, your No Coast host with the most, and I am joined, as always, by my beautiful co-host, Connor Cornelius. Connor, welcome. I'm so glad to see you again. You didn't die this week.
I know, and it's been a little bit of I've been hard-pressed to do that lately.
Yeah, I actually had some money on it, and I'm a little disappointed that I'm going to lose out on that.
I've got a hot tip next week. I think you might want to drop a little bit extra in there.
I'm going swimming with the sharks. We're going to be doing that. Odds have never been better of Connor's death.
Untimely demise.
Untimely. We'll be sad about it.
We'll dress it up a bit.
Yeah. We've got a great episode for you today. First, we talked to, in our feature presentation segment, we talked to the fantastically intelligent.
The technical director for the Music Box.
Yes, Julian Antos. He is the technical director for the Music Box, and he is also the programmer for the 70mm Film Festival, a fantastic event that's going on at the Music Box from June 30th to July 15th. They've got so many great films in 70mm that they're going to be projecting. 2001 A Space Odyssey, Hook, Top Gun, Spartacus, West Side Story, Kong Skull Island, and Interstellar.
So why don't you pick up a ticket for about $12-13 and let Sparta kiss you on the cheek? Whoa, right? Yeah.
Well, if that's not going to convince them, I don't know what will. But we talked to Julian Antos about 70mm film, and also about the Music Box itself, why film is so important, and why it's so tough to get people into theaters nowadays. Then in our fantastic after credits segment, we talk 20 years of Con Air, the Nicolas Cage film co-starring John Cusack.
And let me just tell you
John
right
Malkovich.
Now, we're entering the cage, but one of us might not leave.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
We enter the cage with a very special guest, and you'll just have to stick around and find out who that is. And that's for 20 years of Con Air. But for right now, it's coming attractions time. Connor, you've got some stories for us. We're going to be talking a little bit about what's going on in the world of film. What's happening? What's going on?
So we got a little bit of a sequel here, a continuation of a story that we've kind of been following. The meteoric rise of DC's perhaps greatest film that they've put out since The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit of a normative opinion, but I think that a lot of people would agree with it. Wonder Woman has continued to be a box office force both domestically in the United States and abroad, which if you follow the success of films abroad, it's a little bit of a give and take there. So Wonder Woman shattered expectations, and this comes to us from Variety, earning $103 million in North America during its opening week, but now it has earned up to $601.6 million.
And that's worldwide.
Yeah, and that is worldwide.
Wow. That is massive. That is massive.
Compared with its peers like Pirates of the Caribbean or the new Transformers movie, a lot of those films are really depending on like success in Chinese markets and other international markets. Mm-hmm. Wonder Woman has continued to be both a critical and a box office success at home and abroad.
Right. It is one of the few films of note recently that has had a pretty much even distribution between the take here in the United States and also in the international markets. It's splitting about even. So roughly 300 million here, 300 million abroad, which is so weird nowadays because, as you mentioned, Pirates of the Caribbean, that's getting by just on international dollars. Same goes for Transformers, if that even does well. Right now, the opening is not looking so great. Mm. That opened on Wednesday, I believe. And it's not looking so good. It's the lowest for the franchise.
Facing panning by critics.
Yeah, naturally. It was given a zero-star review in Rolling Stone.
Rough.
Which, I'm not a person that reads a lot of Rolling Stone, but good for them for taking a stand on something for once.
No.
I'm sorry. That's an episode of Hot Takes.
That's another hot take.
It's another hot take. But, Wonder Woman proving to be a great success is the third highest-grossing film of the year. Mm-hmm. What is that behind?
It's behind Beauty and the Beast from Disney and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 from Marvel and, by proxy, Disney.
Yeah. So the top two, Disney killing it. But good job,
shout
DC.
Out to Disney.
Shout out to Disney. Disney,
come on the show.
Just come on the show. Yeah, just talk about it. But good job to director Patty Jenkins for turning out a great film that hopefully gives DC a fighting chance in the cinematic realm. Because I don't want to see them fail. I didn't want Batman versus Superman to be bad.
No, you want these movies to be good and not just slogs to experience.
Exactly. Connor, what's next on the docket?
So bringing that back to Chicago, the jewel of the Midwest, Chicagoans recently found a rare 35mm print of the film Suspiria, which was made in the mid-70s, and it's coming to the big screen. And now, if you're unfamiliar with Suspiria, it's a cult horror classic that was directed by Dario Argento, and it was an Italian filmmaker. And this film that they found is an uncut Italian print of the 77 original. They found it in a warehouse, and it's very few signs of wear from the people who have inspected it. It's just an emblematic example of an old-school 35mm print.
Right.
And people are going to be getting the opportunity to view that.
That's incredible. And I know it's already getting so many requests to be projected all around, not just in the United States,
yeah,
all around the world. People have found out that here in Chicago we have this rare print and they are begging for it to come to their theater. And really, I mean, really there are very few theaters that could probably do it. Not a lot of big theaters have their film projectors anymore at this point. And it's worth noting that this is a landmark film for the giallo genre. Now, giallo film is the specifically Italian take on thrillers and thriller horrors, you know, a lot of slasher stuff, very pulpy, very violent. And Dario Argento is a massive figure in that world. Suspiria is also getting a remake soon. So it's interesting that it should be found at this point. The remake is being done. It's set to be released this year. And actually, it's going to star Chloe Grace Moretz, Tilda Swinton, Dakota Johnson in this kind of kitschy film. It's kind of interesting that it should be found at this point.
And as you will eventually find out, a lot of these bigger movie theaters that have sort of outsourced their projection materials to be digital only, mm-hmm, are going to be missing out, and you're going to be able to see Suspiria at a little bit more of your local kind of a theater. The technical director of the Music Box, who we interview in our B segment, there is a to-be-determined date where Suspiria, this cut, will actually be filmed there.
Right. Right, it will get its day in the sun,
or at least in the dimly lit.
Put it in the sun, for the love of God,
yeah, please.
Keep it safe. But that's incredible. So a little bit of history, film history, added to Chicago yet again. What else is happening here? We got any more stories? Oh, so something I wanted to bring up is the Han Solo solo film. The Han Solo solo film. Solo Dolo, Solo Solo. What happened with this, I'm sure you guys have been following it a little bit, but originally the film was being directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are super well known. They did the 21 and 22 Jump Street films. They did the Lego Movie, very famous for that, and they've done a lot of stuff over the last few years, both in film and television. They had a show called The Last Man on Earth, which is still going. They helped create that. But they have been summarily fired from the Han Solo movie, both of them, over creative differences, essentially.
That old foil.
Yeah, the old saying is, oh, just creative differences. It wasn't working. Now, this movie is about, 6 months into production already. Odds are most of the major set pieces have been shot. But they're still struggling now to get it done, so much that they have hired Ron Howard.
Of Arrested Development and Drive fame.
And we cannot forget American Graffiti, and I believe Happy Days. He was on Happy Days.
Yep.
But, I mean, let's not be cruel. He is a very well-known director, a very competent director. He's being brought on to finish the film. But I have some serious issue with Kathleen Kennedy, who is the head of Lucasfilm, and Lawrence Kasdan, who is a legend in film himself, has been tied with the Star Wars franchise since Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, which films he wrote?
He wrote Empire, and I believe he wrote Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
So he's a massive figure in Star Wars, you know, franchise history. But I have a huge problem with this idea that only Kathleen Kennedy and Lawrence Kasdan know what's right for Star Wars.
Yeah, as if they have the only rights to be able to, like, tell a story within that universe.
Exactly. And this was the same problem that was had back in 1997, 98, when they started making Star Wars Episode One. Now, I know I don't want to talk too much Hollywood, but this is something that I think is affecting every film viewer. There are very few people that watch movies that refuse to watch Star Wars. And you know what? Most people are going to go see these movies. So I want to comment on this because, honestly, screw you, Lawrence Kasdan. Like, who do you think you are? Seriously. You hire Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are extremely capable directors, extremely well known at this point by the, if you don't know them by name, you know them by their work. And they legitimately just know what they're doing. They have a great track record of making good films, and you fired them because they weren't making the Star Wars movie you wanted them to make. I think that's incredibly unfair.
Yeah, and it's just disrespectful because these are filmmakers in their own right that have challenged what most people think of when they want to go see. They're subversive with their filmmaking.
Extremely.
And it's, you know, that is something that could be injected into the Star Wars franchise. I think that The Force Awakens, I enjoyed it as a cinema-going experience. However, it didn't really take very many risks.
Yeah.
Rogue One, I think, was a good example of taking some more risks. And this Han Solo standalone film, or this anthology, part of an anthology series, it could have, you know, it could have gone in a interesting direction that was going to be helmed under those two people. And now that we have Ron Howard in it, it's
going to be establishment.
Yeah.
That's all they want. It seems like Hollywood kind of has this obsession now with hiring on kind of hot indie directors. And I mean, I'm behind the curve on this. This has been happening for a while. Jurassic World did it with Colin Trevorrow. He started out kind of an indie filmmaker, and then he made Jurassic World, and he made the movie that the studio wanted him to make, and it made a buttload of money. It was the highest grossing film of that year, I believe.
Yeah, classic example of a filmmaker with an emergent voice in the zeitgeist, and then totally changes it just at the whims of a studio.
Exactly. You have Rian Johnson, who's going to be doing Star Wars Episode 8. Who knows where that's going to go? And then number 9, Colin Trevorrow again. And there have been some situations where it has totally backfired and virtually ended a guy starting out a very young career. The Fantastic Four reboot that came out a few years ago at this point.
Which one?
Yeah, exactly. It was the reboot starring Michael B. Jordan. And really,
William Teller?
Miles Teller.
Miles Teller.
William
Teller. Oh my God, that is.
And his overture.
I was wrong.
But there was that, and it was directed by Josh Trank, who was kind of an up and coming director. And that movie bombed because of studio interference. He even took to Twitter and later removed the tweet, basically saying, I'm not at fault for this. This is 20th Century Fox stepping in and telling us what to do. If we want to go back a ways to Alien 3, directed by David Fincher, who is easily one of the best living filmmakers out there right now, at least in the States. And that movie totally tanked. Like, it did not do well critically or financially. It could have ended his career right there, but luckily he was able to just be like, hey, I made one bad movie isn't going to kill my career. But it's just, this is going to keep happening if we allow corporate forces, and I don't want to sound like, you know, too much of a hippie here. But it's true. This is what happens. Corporate forces come in and they interfere with art. It takes a lot of training and a lot of skill and a lot of work to become a director. It doesn't take a lot of training or a lot of skill. Maybe some, you know, the ability to convince people of things, but it doesn't take a lot of hard work to become a Hollywood exec, honestly. And I'm willing to say that on the mic. I think that you don't need to know a lot about movies to legitimately work in the movie business from that standpoint. You simply have to make it seem like you know what you're talking about. It's a consistent issue of people failing upwards. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
And everybody knows that the process of filmmaking is it's inundated with bad compromises.
Yeah.
Right? So somebody wants to wear a mustache on set, and then the people at Fox say, no, we don't want a mustache. And then the shadowy people behind say, no, maybe we just go no mustache. And then the guy goes, yeah, well, I'm going to have a mustache. And so, okay, fine, just shave it up a little bit. That's a compromise. And that is exactly the kind of thing that you see with execs trying to take what somebody has as a vision for a character or a mm-hmm. property and trying to bastardize it in some sort of way.
All right, enough of this Star Wars talk. We've talked too much Hollywood already. I just kind of had to have – I felt like I needed to have an airing of grievances. I was pretty upset about this because I guess I'm just a fan of Phil Lord and Chris Miller. But more importantly, we're going to talk Chicago film. We got to talk Chicago film, and that's coming up next with our talk with Julian Antos. He is the technical director of the Music Box, and he is also the programmer of the 70mm Film Fest, a fantastic festival showcasing one of the most beautiful formats in film, 70mm. Big images, big sound. If you've never heard of 70mm, or you just want to learn a little bit more about it and what Julian does, stick around. He's coming up next here on No Coast Cinema on WGN+. Stick around, guys. Back, everybody. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN+. We are your guide to Chicago cinema and cinema around the world. I'm your host, Tom Hush, and back again from the first segment and for every segment is my co-host, Connor Cornelius. Connor, welcome back again.
Gracias por la introducción, Tom. Oh, perdón. Puedo cambiar a inglés. Thank you, Tom, for that introduction. And I speak Spanish so well that sometimes it just bleeds out. Yeah.
Is it true that when you get really fluent in a language, you just dream in it?
Yes, it is true. Although, not for me.
It's not for me. The dream is dead. Dreaming in other languages aside, we have a fantastic guest today. He is from the Music Box. If you have never been to the Music Box and you live in Chicago, I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's one of the most historic theaters in the city. It is one of the most loved theaters in the city. It has diverse programming from classics to current indies to stuff like the films of Edgar Wright. They recently did a great, great series on the films of Edgar Wright, all on 35mm film. But yes, the Music Box is a place for fans of cinema and movies and what have you to congregate and watch and enjoy in a beautiful theater that was built in, or at least opened in 1929, I believe. And today we are joined by Julian Antos. He is the technical director of the Music Box, and he is also the programmer of their festival, the 70mm Festival. Now, the 70mm Film Festival is an event that runs from June 30th to July 15th this year. And what they do is showcase a bunch of different films that were all printed. Julian, maybe you could say it a little bit better than I can.
Yeah, somehow they've all ended up on 70mm film. They were shot in all sorts of various methods. And this festival really runs the full spectrum of production methods. But the point is they all made it to 70 somehow or another.
They all made it to that beautiful, beautiful film format known as 70mm film. And we're looking at films like 2001 A Space Odyssey, Sleeping Beauty, Top Gun, Spartacus, Kong Skull Island, something as recent as that, all being projected on 70mm film. So welcome to NoCo Cinema. Julian, how are you doing today?
Thank you very much. I'm doing well.
So as the programmer of this fest, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the history of the film festival itself.
Yeah, so this is something the Music Box Theater has been doing for about 5 years now, and we do it basically every year and a half. We call it yearly, but we kind of space it out because it's a lot of work. And we started doing it on a regular basis when The Master came out, and that renewed a lot of interest in 70mm film projection. And there were a lot of people who had never seen it before, myself included, who attended that screening of The Master and were just blown away by what the format could do. You know, I grew up seeing movies on 35 all the time, and it's great and wonderful. And around that time, film was becoming a more rarefied thing and slipping out of the multiplexes and being replaced with digital. So that 70 screening of The Master, you know, came at a time when it felt just really important and relevant, and we sort of latched onto that and have been running with it ever since.
And we've seen a kind of a decent resurgence in that fanfare. I know Quentin Tarantino did a national tour with his new movie, The Hateful Eight, right?
They made about 100 prints of that in 70mm, which was kind of ridiculous. It was kind of too many prints,
right?
That was a pretty big deal, pretty big undertaking.
So with some recent movies coming out in the format, how has the public reacted to the more recent installments of the 70mm Fest?
I think it's been really overwhelmingly positive, and it's really interesting to see after, you know, decades of film projection just being like a normal thing that people didn't even think about. Now it's, with this festival, it's at the forefront, and it's, you know, the festival is designed around the movies we show, of course, but it's really a film festival about a specific format, and it's very sort of geeky, and people who have never thought about it before are very interested in it.
It does play to a certain audience that wants to see 70mm film and knows what it is. With 70mm film, now, before The Hateful Eight, I will confess, I did not know about this format. And when they were just like, oh, it's going to be projected in 70mm.
So it worked.
Yeah, exactly. And they were talking about it like it was this glorious thing. And I had just zero idea what 70mm film is. Julian, what is 70mm film versus other types versus digital projection?
Well, it's film, only it's bigger. So we have at the very, very bottom end, we have Super 8, which is what people shot a lot of home movies on for a very long time, Super 8 and regular 8mm. And then there's 16mm, which is maybe if you were a little more wealthy, you'd shoot your home movies on that. And that's how a lot of libraries and prisons and churches exhibited feature films. They'd rent it from a library or something like that. And 35 was what was in all the movie theaters across the country and across the world for over 100 years. And then there's 70, which is the biggest of them all, and it's twice as wide and 1.25 times as tall as 35mm film physically. And the images can be as big or small as you want it, but the point is there's more detail in that enormous frame. And 70 was limited to like major cities and major markets, New York, Los Angeles, Detroit at the time. And there would be maybe 100 engagements in 70mm of a big title in the 60s or so.
So why use 70mm? When shooting these films, what was the draw of using this film format versus just 35mm?
Well, at the time 70 came out, it was competing with television. So theater exhibitors and production companies were trying to get people out of their house to see movies in public, which is sort of the same problem we're battling today with Netflix and whatever. So that was probably the primary draw for really making things bigger and stereo sound and providing a, you know, an overwhelming experience that, you know, felt like going out to the opera or something like that.
So in comparison to that 35mm standard, 70mm has been said to be up to four times the resolution of that normal format. So clearly, especially Tom mentioned that 2001 A Space Odyssey is mm-hmm. going to be showing there, and that's obviously a buffet for the eyes.
Yeah.
So the public is clearly going to be benefiting from that. But for as somebody that is an operator behind the scenes having to actually heft this stuff around, what kind of a physical, like, demand, I guess, is it behind the behind?
It's kind of comical. The prints are on 20-minute reels, and each reel weighs about 30 or 40 pounds.
Oh, my God.
And you're switching between two projectors every 20 minutes and doing changeovers, and so you have to lift it up and thread it and make sure the focus is good and framing is good and sound is good. And
so this is a physical task.
Yeah.
This is like you are getting down and dirty to project these
yep.
films.
Drop your gym membership, people.
Yeah.
Just get paid $10 an hour at the local your local theater hefting these things up.
Exactly, exactly. So with the 70mm Film Festival, not only are you the technical director, you are also the programmer mm-hmm. for this festival. So why this set of films? 2001 A Space Odyssey seems like kind of a foregone conclusion. It is that visual buffet that Connor was talking about. But we're looking at Top Gun 70
that's
millimeters.
That's a rare print, actually.
Yeah, where would one – what is – how did you choose some of these movies?
So it's – what we're dealing with is a kind of limited slate, actually, because there are not a whole lot of movies that are actually shot in 70 millimeter. You know, under 75, I would say. That number might be wrong, but whatever. about 75 or so.
Okay.
And of those, not all of them survive in good, showable 70mm prints, so that limits it a bit further. So when we're talking shot and printed on 70mm, maybe we have a couple dozen titles to choose from. And we always run 2001. We almost always run Lawrence of Arabia. That's taking a break this year, but it'll come back. And then we have some more obscure titles. And then there's prints that are blow-ups, films that were shot on 35mm and were blown up to 70. That was really common in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So we have Top Gun. And that was done. The image on those looks very good, but the primary purpose of the blow-ups is to get really good sound from the magnetic soundtrack, which I think still, if the track is in good condition, represents pretty much the best sound quality you can have
really?
Anywhere.
So that jump from 35mm to 70 will how does it expand the kind of range of sound or just give
yeah,
it more
so,
dynamic range?
So 35mm at the time in the 80s was usually achieved through optical sound, which is if you've seen Fantasia, they'll show you the string on the harp being plucked and looking at an optical soundtrack. It's basically a visual representation of sound. Mm-hmm. And it's very ingenious and it sounds really good. But there's a sort of limited dynamic range and a little bit of compression. So when they developed magnetic sound, the dynamic range is almost limitless. It represents the whole spectrum of human hearing, and there's six discrete channels of sound.
Wow.
We ran a reel from the Top Gun print, and the walls were shaking. It's great.
You can hear I'll Always Be Your Wingman
yep.
just in the most clear, beautiful sound. I want to hear so many of those lines from Top Gun. I got
yeah,
the need.
It makes it a good movie.
Yeah.
Because I've heard Tom Cruise does speak in the full range of human hearing.
Yeah, just we're unfortunate enough not to get it. But now, for the first time, you can get it in 70mm film. With you talked a little bit about how 70mm was an attempt to get, you know, people back into the theaters by offering something that television and home media eventually, when you get into the VHS era, just couldn't deliver. Now we have 4K TVs, mm-hmm. you know, 11.1 surround sound systems. What, in your opinion, is going to get people back into the theaters? Where's the problem with getting people to experience film in its arguably its intended format?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when we do these screenings, we sort of try and educate our audience on what they're actually seeing. You're saying, you know, this is an old vintage print. It's a one of a kind art object, basically, and it is kind of hard to push because it's very easy to say, you know, digital 4K, whatever, maximum resolution. Mm-hmm. But what you're looking at when you're seeing a film print projected is something that's photochemical, that's difficult to measure. There's a color spectrum, which is, I think, totally different from what we see in digital. There's a different way of seeing light, but that's a little difficult to market. You know, you can't, mm-hmm. you're trying to describe all these subtle qualities when the multiplex down the street is pushing like Sony 4K 3D, whatever. But, you know, the easiest thing to say is just this is really beautiful and one of a kind, which is totally true.
I do want to get your opinion. I want to get some opinions from around the room here. So we were all old enough to remember seeing films still shown on film.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of an abstract thing I'm going for here. It's kind of weird, but like, describe to me, if you guys can, your earliest memories going to the movies and seeing something projected. Julian, if you want to go first.
I think it might have been Muppets in Outer Space.
Oh my gosh.
At the Davis Theater.
Either that
or the live action 101 Dalmatians at it would have been when Water Tower Place still had a theater in the basement. And I remember, I think that's the earliest I can remember. I saw like a speck of dust, and I asked, my aunt took me, and I said, what is that? She said, it's a speck of dust on the film. I said, on the film?
Wow. What do you
Amazing.
Mean?
Like, you see the, I'm not exactly sure what it's called. I think it's been explained to me in
changeover cue.
Yeah, what is the little bubble maybe in the corner of the screen? I remember seeing that.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a theater when there was like a mishap, or was that a speck of dust?
I've been responsible for many mishaps.
Oh, really?
how long have you been projecting?
Maybe 7 or 8 years or so. I sort of grew up around movie theaters a little bit. My parents had friends who worked at movie theaters, and it was just sort of part of my life growing up.
How does one learn to become a projectionist, other than the obvious, you start working at a movie theater?
Yeah,
you got to
tug on the arm of a projectionist and find one somewhere and be persistent, and then they'll teach you.
It's like an apprenticeship, almost.
Yeah, because there is an art to it. You have to do things at the right time and make sure that it lines up, and it's, as you said, in focus and it's in the right place. Mm-hmm. I know... fairly recently, because I wish I could go to more Music Box films, like, you know, 35 millimeter screenings, but fairly recently I went to see Akira, mm-hmm. which was fantastic. The print that you guys had was beautiful, and despite its age, like, I mean, there was some damage to the film, that's just, you know, a given, but it looked beautiful, and I enjoyed it so much. And then I kind of hoped it would happen from this sort of macabre point of view. I was like, oh, I've seen it happen in movies, but I've never seen a film reel like splice or have to be fixed. And like literally 10 minutes from the finale, just and like the lights came on and everything. And how do you even fix that? Like, what does it feel like when that happens?
Oh, it's terrible, especially if there's a lot of people in the audience. I mean, all sorts of things can go wrong, but the nice thing about film is you can usually get up and running real quick. Mm-hmm. With digital, if it's a software issue or something like that, you could be off screen for a whole day. With film, usually you can, find the right spare part or stick a rubber band on something and,
just
get it all together. Through the show. The machines we have are very reliable for the most part. They're maybe 50 or 60 years old at this point, but they keep on running. You just got to oil them.
Mm-hmm. So with the Music Box, how long have you been there?
I've been working here in this position like 2 years, but I've worked there part-time off and on for 5 or 6 years.
What's it like working there? I mean, we're talking about a historic landmark, mm-hmm. in the city of Chicago, not just for, you know, for its aesthetic qualities from the outside and inside, but as a cultural touchstone, what's the feeling you get when you walk into work?
It's great. It's still, you know, even day in, day out, it's rewarding. Yeah. I always find, you know, so, you know, what the best thing is when there's a great screening and people are walking out of the theater and are saying, wow, I can't believe I just saw that, or I can't believe how great that just was. And you feel like you've made a difference.
It seems like the Music Box is always throwing out these kind of oddball, not oddball, but these things specific for a specific community. Like, I know that you've screened The Room a lot.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, I've never actually seen that movie, but obviously I've heard that it's hard to avoid that movie's reputation.
But so you have a hot take on The Room?
I shouldn't say anything.
Okay.
Okay.
It's a wonderful movie that people are able to find joy in. So, that's
so I wanted to ask, is the Music Box a film-only venue, or do you do
digital
projection?
No, we do digital projection. I mean, most of the new movies we show are on DCP, which is the industry standard for digital projection. But we run film in both theaters, both our little one and our big one, and digital. So you kind of have to, unless you're Quentin Tarantino and can, you know, run the New Beverly and do only film, you kind of have to do digital. But we try and run as much film as we can.
What is your opinion on Quentin Tarantino has been very outspoken. He's gone so far to say that he will quit directing when it's no longer possible to project his films or any films on film. So what is your opinion on digital projection, and do you think that it is necessarily the future of projection, or
I think the two technologies need to be to exist side by side. If I had my way, it would be only film all the time.
Okay.
That's what I love. And digital is good for some stuff, but it's kind of this homogenized, boring idea of what the movies can be. And, you know, a lot of the best screenings I've seen are on film, and I think there's just so much potential there, and it's so beautiful. But there's a lot of money to be made in digital. Some companies have gotten very rich converting theaters. The movies are a product of capitalism, and we kind of need to deal with that.
Got to work within the system at some point.
And, you know, with the – where was I going? We'll cut this out. We'll cut out the stumbling. So it reminds me a lot of the idea of what's happening in the music industry as well with vinyl versus digital. I mean, on one hand, you've got literally every song you could ever listen to ever available in a tiny little rectangle in your pocket versus having a library that you have to pay for each single, you know, item, and it takes time and care and all these things, and yet it's back to being, you know, almost a $1 billion business, just the vinyl itself. So I really liked what you said about where digital and film just need to kind of coexist.
Mm-hmm.
You have theaters like the Music Box that are, and the New Beverly in LA, and a bunch of other theaters around there are still going to show film screenings for the people who care about the effort that people like yourself put in, and that the directors and, you know, directors of photography put in all those years ago and still do in the case of some of these films. But do you feel that there is greater interest now in these film screenings versus maybe, I don't know, 5 to 10 years ago when digital was really the wave of the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a little bit of pushback, and you know, the conversation just keeps going. And, you know, five years ago, I think, like, if we did an Edgar Wright series at the Music Box,
nothing.
Yeah, there would have been some amount of interest. But this time around, you know, you saw a screening of Shaun of the Dead with 150 people on a Tuesday night or whatever, and it's great. So I think people are people, and it's a general pushback. I think people want to get away from their phones a little bit and get out of the house and, you know, feel like they're not tied to technology. And
return to the real world, you know? Yeah. Get back to the real world.
And the Music Box is obviously dedicated to bringing that kind of an experience to the people that are interested. Mm-hmm. What are you – you mentioned that maybe you go out and you – before the showing, you maybe do a little bit of a seminar, maybe explain a little bit about the history of the reels and where they're coming from.
Yeah, for the 70 Fest specifically, definitely.
So was that taking place at the beginning of every screening? Because that sounds like something that I would really enjoy.
Yeah, almost every screening at the 70 Fest, either I or someone else will introduce and give a little background on where the print's coming from and, you know, why it looks the way it does.
Well, it sounds like you guys are doing it's a great thing for the curating the experience.
Yeah, It's a service. We've been talking to Julian Antos. He is the technical director. Technical director?
Yeah, technical director.
All right, I was
director of...
Director of Technics.
The turntable?
The turntable. Oh, how the turntables are... we are talking to Julian Antos, technical director of the Music Box Theater, here in Chicago, and he is also the programmer for the 70mm Film Festival. That festival is happening from June 30th to July 15th, and you can get your tickets right now. You can get them over at musicboxtheater.com, or can they go to the box office and get tickets ahead of time as well?
Yeah, it's the old-fashioned way. That's fine.
Exactly. Go get it the old-fashioned way, maybe. Stop in the box office. Just some of the films are going to be showing 2001 A Space Odyssey, Spartacus, West Side Story, and even recent films such as Kong, Skull Island, and Interstellar. They've got... some of the prices, 70mm festival pass, you can get for $75. If you're a Music Box member, get it for $60. You just got to get out there and see it. See some of these beautiful films on the grandest format known to man, 70mm film. Thank you so much, Julian, for coming on NoCo Cinema. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank
anytime.
You.
All right. We will be back in just a little bit here on NoCo Cinema. We are on WGN Plus, and we are also your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. Back in just a bit.
Whose world is this? It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this? It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this? It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush, back again. And, of course, we welcome back from the break, Connor Cornelius.
Con Air Cornelius.
Con Air Cornelius. And that joke will make sense in about 5 minutes. But I'm glad you made it through the break, Connor.
Could I talk? Just come here for a second. Just talk about this.
Okay. What's wrong,
Tom? I don't know. Just something you said earlier is you went and saw Akira at a theater without me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought you wouldn't. I didn't think it was that big of a deal.
Oh, I think you knew. I think you know what it was.
Right.
A big deal.
Fine. If you're gonna be this way,
it's just,
you know, I'm not gonna go to you.
I know that we're not like cool or anything, but like, just
I know I hate you, but I guess I need to invite you to more films.
Just something.
We'll do the next one.
All right,
we'll do the next one. I know there's a bunch of Ghibli movies playing soon, so I'll take you to My Neighbor Totoro, and then we'll call it even.
All right,
how's
fine.
That sound?
Yeah,
okay. NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We're in our after credit sequence here, and for this, we are going to do a segment that we haven't done since the first episode, and. In honor of that, I wanted to bring back our guest from the first episode. He is the creator, the mastermind behind Capper Movie House, and he is also a writer and director in his own right. Please welcome back to the program, Mr. Jake Wiseman. Welcome
hey
back,
guys.
Jake.
How's it going?
Thanks for coming onto the show, Jake.
Well, I got tickets to see Aquila and the Bee last night. I called you, and you didn't pick up.
Yeah,
I don't really understand.
I gave you a deliberately an incorrect number.
Well, now that I
so
heard
who
your
hates
conversation
who?
With Tom, I think I understand what's going on. It's not Aquila and the
All
Bee.
All right, well, it's me. So, it's a me problem.
There's a lot of hate in this room, and it's time
to... Oh, no, I love both of you.
Oh, yeah? All right, so like I said, after credit sequence, we're going to do something that we haven't done since the first episode, and I'm so excited that we're doing it again. We are going to enter the cage.
How to get burned?
I don't know!
Hey, have you ever been dragged to the sidewalk and bee until you...
pissed blood! Someone's trying to kill me, man!
I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire!
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees!
Yeah, we...
Oh, my God.
The official...
Somebody trying to kill me, man!
Oh my God. Wow.
That is the official theme song of Enter the Cage.
That's what I was hoping that theme song was, and it more than met expectations.
I'm really glad it did. I'm really glad it did. So we are now inside the cage, and we are going to be talking about something that is near and dear to all of us.
That's true.
This year, 2017, marks the 20th anniversary of one of the greatest films ever made.
Bar none.
Con Air, starring, of course, Nicolas Cage, but also starring John Malkovich, Steve Buscemi.
Yes.
Ving Rhames.
Yes. In a commanding
role. Dave Chappelle.
John Cusack.
Yes. Cole Meany.
Cole Meany.
For all you Trek heads out there.
Basically, a who's who of the 1990s.
It's a who's who of film, cinema.
Right. I mean,
everyone is still relatively relevant now, right?
In their own way. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great cast. The film was released.
MC Gainey.
The film was released on June 6, 1997. It's directed by Simon West, produced by Jerry Bruckheimer.
Yeah, it was.
In a coke-fueled rampage, decided that he was going to make Con Air. The budget, $75 million. The gross domestic box office, $224 million.
Could you imagine being able to spend $75 million on that kind of a movie now?
No, that's the sad part.
For like an original kick-ass action movie
filled with
your favorite action stars and filled with your favorite non-action stars,
right,
like John Cusack, who would later on push Tin, I believe.
Yes.
But that wasn't before Con Air.
Well, I think was he in Gross Point Blank? Is that an action film?
For that matter, is Pushing Tin really an action film?
I don't know.
Does he do action films? The Raven, is that an action film?
That, you know what? That might have to be for another segment. Enter the Sack.
Well, no, because we can do, what is that movie, Frozen Ground, with Nicolas Cage and John Cusack?
Yep, that was more recent, right?
It was terrible.
Yeah, that's true.
It was, you know, whatever. Anyway, Con Air.
Anyway,
Con Air. Cornelius.
Welcome back.
Yeah. So 20 years of Con Air, and it's got this really great legacy, I think, of being just... an action movie is it's not even that ridiculous in concept, but it's a little ridiculous in concept.
Absolutely ridiculous in execution.
And had its time in the sun as like one of those movies you would catch on TV all the time. I would say it was at Shawshank Redemption level, that most people first saw Con Air, at least in my age, on TV. Actually, I wanted to ask you, Jake, when was the first time you saw Con Air?
I was too young for it in the theater. I was 10 years old when it came out in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm pretty sure I saw it my brother's DVD collection. And it may or may not have been my first John Malkovich movie, which is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
right.
trying to figure that out right now, if I had seen Being John Malkovich first. And I'm pretty sure if that's the case, then I would have seen In the Line of Fire first as well. So that's mm-hmm. like two psycho John Malkovich roles followed by Cyrus the Virus, which is... maybe the best John Malkovich role of all time, which he would not want to hear. But, I mean, that's debatable. I mean, the shit that comes out of that guy's mouth is just incredible, and he does it so well.
Exactly. Connor, when was the first time you saw Connor?
It must have been a couple of years ago, honestly. I was pretty late to the game with that one, considering I had seen Ghost Rider by the time I had seen Connor at least, I'm going to say a dozen, Baker's dozen.
Just, my God.
you watch Ghost Rider that many times?
To this day, the only film that my friend and I paid to see in a theater twice.
The first one?
Yeah. I wish it had been Spirit of Vengeance.
I never saw the second one.
Yeah, me either.
Wow.
But he does incorporate a Novo Shamanic acting style in the Spirit of Vengeance.
How old were you when the first one came out?
I think the first one was 2007, something like that.
Yeah.
So, I would have been like 14. Yeah.
Perfect age.
Exactly.
Great age.
It's the perfect age to watch that over and over again. I saw it in the theater. I remember seeing it in the theater and just being like, no one can see my face, my very confused, scrunched face right now.
But Con Air, what were some of your first impressions of seeing this movie?
Con Air.
Yeah, Con Air
is perfect from beginning to end. Throughout its flaws, of which there seems to be a handful, it's still perfect.
Really?
And because it fulfills exactly what it sets out to do. I was watching it earlier, and I was like, this movie is masterful at exposition. Just 20 minutes of setting everything up, and it spirals outward, so you can just see why they're setting it all up. And it's hilarious and silly and like...
It's dark.
It's dark, but also, like, these characters, I think the most thing that I got out of this last time I watched it is that, like, all of the characters have one function, and they serve that function.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't much else going on with the characters.
I felt the same thing when I was watching. I watched it today, actually. I think that Steve Buscemi's role, it was, like, all of the best writing in the movie was just like, all right, we'll just have Steve Buscemi sit there very, very properly and just repeat these insane, like...
He was in Fargo.
Exactly. You know? He knows how to...
What do we want Steve Buscemi to say? What would be great to hear come out of his mouth, kind of a thing? And, like, I don't know how John Malkovich got involved with this project. I don't know why I'm just going to keep talking about Cyrus the Virus.
Absolutely.
I just think his lines are easily my favorite lines in the entire thing.
Let's set it up for people who have not seen Con Air. The basic premise of this.
Poor bastards.
Yeah,
I haven't seen Con Air yet.
I mean, I saw it on TV, and I was just like, this is possibly one of the most fun movies I've ever seen. But the basic premise of Con Air is you've got Nick Cage, and he is Army Ranger, ex-Army Ranger Cameron Poe.
The perfect soldier.
The perfect soldier, the fighting machine.
His age is, we're not quite sure about his age.
No, we have no idea how old he is.
He's got long, luscious locks, but his hairline would suggest otherwise.
I'm pretty sure this was written for like a 23-year-old, and it ended up going to Nicolas Cage, who was late 30s.
Yeah, at least.
At best.
At least. So he is ex-Army Ranger Cameron Poe. He leaves the military.
On parole?
No.
He's just discharged.
Yeah, he finishes his tour.
What's it called? Honorary discharge. Like,
he gets his honorary discharge. He's done with being a ranger.
Yeah.
And he goes back home to Alabama to see his wife.
His one and only. Beautiful wife.
To his daughter that he hasn't seen.
No.
Well,
not
14
even,
years.
Not yet. No. This is the beginning.
Well, it's the beginning, so she's pregnant.
Yeah, she's pregnant.
Oh, you're right. Okay.
Yeah. Come on, Connor.
I'm sorry. I was,
get
we're named
we
after
were talking,
this film.
You're right. That's so true.
So he goes back home to Alabama to see his beautiful wife. He's trim. He's got a great hairline.
He's looking good.
He's like, looking fine.
Like he finally got out of the army and just really got his shit together like he was supposed to.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he goes back, and his wife is a waitress in a bar. There's typically some drunk men who want to hit on his wife.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, please go away. I'm not about it. And she's like, no, please go away. I'm not about it. But naturally, these guys are super aggressive, and they eventually try to pounce on Nick Cage and start just beating the crap out of him.
Well, I mean, it's a little stretched out.
Yeah, I mean, it's the closing time of the bar. He goes, and he ends up getting in a fight with these dudes. He kills one of them. In self-defense, I might add.
And he needs to. Yeah, he cracks that skull.
Yeah, he just murders. Oh. Well, it's not even murder. They
give
him manslaughter.
The guy pulled a knife on him, too.
Yeah, exactly. But he gets charged with manslaughter And I think one of the greatest lines of this movie is the judge telling Cameron Poe that because he is an Army Ranger, the law, like, laws do not apply to him the same way, which is one, insane, but also two, the perfect setup for this plot and showing how crazy good Nick Cage is as his character, as an Army Ranger. He is the deadliest weapon. He is so deadly that laws do not apply to him in a normal sense.
Yeah. The judges are scared of him. Yeah. Rapists are scared of him. Everyone is scared of him.
Yeah. Nick Cage.
I mean, you look at that physique. If the guy touched you, he'd break your arm.
But Cameron Poe is an arrow through the wind.
He is.
Like, through this entire movie.
Exactly.
He knows what he's about.
Yep.
And he just...
He never second guesses himself.
Yeah.
Well, he could get off. He does second guess himself for a second because he's about to get off the plane. And then he's like, you know what? I can't leave all you guys here.
I can't leave a man behind, John Cusack. You remember that.
So from getting arrested, he...
Do yourself a favor, remember that.
From getting arrested, he is in prison for a long time. He goes years without seeing his wife, and his daughter is born.
Yeah,
while he's in prison.
Up.
Yeah, and gets to a decent age. She's like 4 years old.
They exchange letters.
Yeah, they exchange letters. It's actually really a really touching sequence of
for an opening credit sequence. Yeah,
for an opening credit sequence, you're hearing him talk to his daughter through letters, and he befriends another prisoner.
Can I just interrupt and say that this is supposed to be a light overview, and we've been talking about the first five,
dude, I'm
ten
sorry,
minutes for
because
like
it's such
five
a,
or 10 minutes.
It's a really great
funny.
Setup.
No, it's perfect.
It's a,
that's
it's
what
a
I was saying
setup.
Before. It's if, like it's a masterful exposition.
If you don't do the Con Air mythos justice, I mean, then what are we doing here?
Yeah, we're setting up the
touche.
The Con Air
the
cinematic universe,
the airborne pantheon. For God's sake,
exactly. So, long story short, he's going back home. He's paroled. And has to go on this plane to get transferred to where he hitches a ride on this, you know, this plane that's transferring prisoners to another prison.
This is, okay, can
okay,
I?
Please, okay, please, by
so
all means.
This is something I was trying to clear up today. What I found out is that there's this other thing that should be a plot point and never is a plot point. I never really picked up on this, is that they've built this maximum security prison. That's where they're going, is mm-hmm. like a brand new, shiny maximum security prison. And so they're shoving the worst of the worst, who are all going to go to this new, like, Alcatraz, I guess, mm-hmm. in, what, Louisiana or something like that? Maybe?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It must be on the way to Alabama, because otherwise, why would Cameron Poe even be on that plane?
Is he in
Mobile?
Is that where he goes to jail?
No, he's going.
Mobile?
He's
where
going
is,
from
where
San.
Is jail?
This is a really weird thing, and I might need to be corrected on this. But he is in. At one point, there's a line of dialogue that one of the prisoners asks Cameron Poe. He asks Nick Cage, "Oh, where you were in the queue, right? The queue is San Quentin, right?
Oh.
Isn't it? That's what I thought. Because why would he get arrested for manslaughter in Alabama and then not go to prison in Alabama?
That happens.
Because the law doesn't apply to him, Tom. You've already been over this.
So maybe that's how they solve
it. But to be fair, you don't necessarily... If you live in Chicago, it doesn't mean you go to Cook County. Like, that's...
Really? If you commit the crime in the...
Doesn't matter. Like,
really?
Yeah, they'll send you wherever.
So I think they send him...
You can go all over the country.
I'm pretty sure they send him to San Quentin.
That's hilarious. Is there... I haven't Googled this. Is there, like, a map of the Con Air...
If not, there should be.
It's in
be.
The Blu-ray. Trip. Yeah, it's those
in the Steelbook.
It's like a semi
the Criterion Collection edition of Con Air.
you can track the continuity.
But
of the
they,
film.
You know what, guys? They never get to that maximum security prison.
No, spoiler they do not.
Alert. Yeah, spoiler alert.
Because a group of prisoners decides the worst of the worst, as Jake said, decides to hijack the plane, and it's up to Cameron Poe and John Cusack as Vince Larkin. Of the he's the U.S. Marshal.
Yes.
He's from the Marshal's office. And Colm Meaney, I don't even know his character's name because the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, that's Colm Meaney.
That's O'Brien.
That's O'Brien,
just
dude.
Just call him O'Brien.
And he is from the DEA. And
it's pronounced DS9.
Get out of
Thank
here.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Go home.
Thank you. Goodbye.
That's Jake Wiseman. Signing off.
The wisest man.
Con Air.
They're trying to bring down. They're trying to bring down this plane by pretty much any means necessary. So that's the setup for the film, and I just want to get to. I want to talk about
so good.
How this setup is perfect for an action film, and there are people out there that look at Con Air as like, oh, it's this kitschy byproduct of the 1990s. But really, this is a great movie, and this is not a ridiculous setup. If we're looking at great action movies, all the greatest action movies have like almost similarly absurd setups.
Sure.
Look at Escape from New York. New York becomes a prison island because crime has risen 400%. And that is the setup.
And is it the United Corporations of America, or is that something else?
Oh, my God. It's something like that. Yeah, may be Escape from L.A., but... same universe, and they hire a criminal. They hire a criminal, Snake Plissken, to go into there, save like the president or something, and get out.
A number one, King of New York.
Exactly. So this is a great setup, and I wish more action movies. Actually, the better action movies of the last few years have had somewhat similar kind of big, a little bit goofy setups. If it's not going for the hyper realism, but the hyper grittiness of like John Wick, which is a great film, great action film, they kind of take the like, you know, sleek sort of action film. They want to go like they're like the Transporter series sort of thing.
And
like,
I think that is kind of funny in its own way, the John Wick series.
Yeah, it has a sense of humor about itself. I don't think an action movie can be a good action movie unless it has a sense of humor about itself, which Con Air, I think, very clearly has.
Yeah,
I hope so.
You have to.
It definitely has a sense of humor about itself. Now, does it know that it's as racist as it is? I don't know. And that's still debatable. But, like, I mean, I was watching that shit, and I was like, interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, if you have John Cusack running around in socks and sandals, then you must have a decent sense of humor about yourself.
Fair point.
Let's talk about these characters. Let's talk about these characters. Because as I like what you said, Jake, about how each prisoner – you don't really get a huge backstory. You get some, you know, idea of who they are. Like
you know what they like to do, and that is their goal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
They're defined by their criminal pasts.
But they're in prison right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're in prison. But they're about to be free, so they can go off and...
and do more prison-worthy things.
I suppose so. I don't know if it's ever really specific as to what a lot of them want to do. I think it's pretty specific what Johnny Ventitrace wants to do.
Oh, yeah.
I think he comes straight out and says that, and they stop that, which is good. But, like...
Dave Chappelle's introduction is really bad, and I noticed that...
Yeah.
I actually read that Dave Chappelle's... his lines were largely improvised in that movie. But just his introduction where, like, the white security guard or whatever is just, like, berating him for existing, and then he's just like, all right, now you've been introduced. Get on the plane.
It's interesting, but it was 20 years ago, and it's not, like, excusing anything, but it definitely – I've been watching some movies from, like, 15, 20 years ago, the ones that I remember from high school, and things have definitely changed, and it's – I don't know.
It's a mixed bag.
It is, because for everything that's bad about this stuff, like bad effects or missteps, there was this kind of like willingness to be original to figure out what was going to make the money. And then once Marvel came around, they kind of figured out how to make the money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Con Air is an experiment.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, like I said, $75 million for a completely original action film, which at the time wasn't crazy. In the late 90s, that's not crazy. There was all sorts of those kinds of movies. The best part of Con Air, and one of the reasons why I think it succeeds through the years for us, is because it's mostly practical. Like, I don't think there's a computer or whatever computer is in there is really kind of hidden pretty
well.
Yeah,
it's very subtle. Like, that plane was real.
Yeah, they're on a plane. Like, they throw that car through, you know, they do all sorts of shit to that car, which is really cool. And like, there's all sorts of things going on in the movie that are practical and actually happening and fighting. And it's
super cool. Like, it's a lot of fun to watch. With the prisoners.
Yeah.
I really.
Let's get back to character.
Yeah.
Character work.
The deep character.
Like, my character is that I need insulin. Right?
Like, yeah, what's
he's
it, baby-o?
Kind of a sweetheart because he's the best friend, but mostly everything that comes out of his mouth is like, you better get me my insulin or I'm going to die.
He spends the entirety of the flight almost dying, right?
That's true. Yeah. And then Nick Cage is like, man, I really want to get back to my daughter, but I'm going to risk it all because my buddy might die from no insulin. Yeah. And then he like finds an abandoned fucking desert or something.
And that's, I don't mean to curse. It's fine. And that's interesting because it makes Cameron Poe such a great character, is that he does the right thing at all times. He could leave and go to his family, which is right in the in one sense
that
of it, cause
first
it's like,
layover.
Yeah, there. When you go to, he's like, I can get off this plane right now.
Yeah.
He got hosed by the system, but that didn't ever sway him from his conventions of right.
He knew that
or wrong.
The right thing to do was to help his friend that he made in prison who needs insulin, and he's like, you know what, and then by default stop that damn plane.
But he's gonna pretend to like be friends with Cyrus and try and get his favor too.
Yeah, and he's gonna always pronounce the word daughter as daughter.
Dotto.
He's just gonna keep
the bunny.
He's gonna keep on going.
I do really want to commend his accent because it is. I think it's pretty great.
What?
could you imagine Cameron Poe without an accent? That was a
no.
choice. That
well,
was a,
no,
that was a great
not.
Choice.
Yeah.
This is set in Mobile, Alabama. That's the answer.
It makes you wonder what kind of work went into that.
Yeah.
You know, how hard did he try to actually nail an Alabama
he worked hard.
Accent?
Well, it's Nicolas Cage. I mean, he's auteur.
He came fresh off of The Rock, right? Like he closed The Rock and then went to Con Air the next day. I'm pretty sure.
Really?
Right? I think so.
Did
he was
the
a
Rock
hot item.
Older?
Yeah.
Oh,
first Michael Bay. Or no, it's not. It's the second Michael Bay. Bad Boys one.
And Jerry right. Bruckheimer did that one as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was like the guy. And I just want to point out that the guy that we've been talking about that needs the insulin, his best buddy on the plane, that's my Kelty Williamson, who you may know as Bubba from Forrest Gump. It was so weird when I recognized him. I was just like, holy cow, he's Baby-O is Bubba.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He's a great actor because I would never have known that necessarily. Like, those two characters are very different.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, but also like he's definitely being cast as like the best friend
who's
needs
dying
help
of insulin
the whole time.
Yeah, he's the one that's gonna bite the dust. He's the one that's gonna bite the dust. So in terms of '90s action films, where does this sit for you guys?
Oh, it's up there.
It reminds me of the like when you think of people satirizing action movies because they are very upfront about what they're talking about and always presenting very clear-cut explanations for what's happening so the dads in the audience don't get lost. Con Air is unapologetically that, and it's not satire.
No, not at all.
That was my impression that I got of this movie while I was watching it.
That any satire is like a runoff, like some sort of
not
like
that
nuclear
it is,
runoff, like
it's
not
just
intentional
Con
whatsoever.
Con Air, like, is that act. It's not the action movie that they're all making fun of, but it just is of that ilk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unapologetically.
Yes. Unapologetically.
It knows exactly what it is.
I think it's like Speed.
You don't want those dads falling asleep.
No. Yeah. And you go back and watch one of its contemporaries, Speed with Keanu Reeves.
Sure.
Like, it's the same thing. What an odd concept. You're on a bus that has a bomb. Why would a terrorist like do such a complicated plan?
But you could argue that many ideas from Con Air probably came from Speed. Like, why would you cast John Malkovich in this role? Because they cast Dennis Hopper in
Cyrus
the last
one.
Yeah. Get a serious actor.
You get some that's known for being a lunatic. Maybe they tried to get Kevin Spacey first. Who knows?
I would have loved to see Kevin Spacey as Cyrus the Virus.
I would have watched Kevin Spacey in either of those movies. I wouldn't give up Dennis Hopper for anything in Speed, but like,
and I wouldn't have given
Kevin Spacey would have done pretty.
Yeah, I wouldn't have given up John Malkovich here
right.
because him as Cyrus the Virus is just so. He's just like, is if John that, Malkovich dead behind the eyes?
If that dick jumps out of your pants, you jump off this plane.
Oh, Cy, Onara. Onara. Boosh.
Okay.
Oh my god.
Hold on.
When I
that
think
scene,
of rapist, you're
freeze
so...
frame. When freeze he frame. Takes the cigarette out of that dude's mouth and throws it into the gasoline, it hits like the only patch of ground that doesn't have any. It's totally dry, and then just an explosion from right some from the right screen just billows yeah, over.
It's beautiful.
That
it's,
timing.
It's
how do
wonderful.
You think of Inara? Sayonara.
Sayonara. So
you
quick.
You gotta be so in the moment.
It's almost like there's a script. And the okay, and the thing is, you were speaking about like that sort of you know, it lands on the one patch where it's like gonna definitely ignite, and it does the whole big explosion thing. I think Jerry Bruckheimer, although he didn't direct it, he produced it. Yeah. And directed by Simon West, but I think Jerry Bruckheimer definitely has his hands all over this one. It feels like a Bruckheimer film. And he nailed Bayhem before Michael Bay brought in Bayhem. He knew yeah. when to do the right set pieces. Like
he
when
introduced
they're in...
Bay
exactly.
to the world, right? Like,
right.
I mean, there was
and,
no
and Michael Bay just Dino took Bay. It to the took it to the limit. Like
Bayo?
Scott Baio?
Oh. Me say Baio.
Oh, my God.
But there, I mean.
Is this Baywatch? Are we on the Baywatch,
Baywatch
segment?
Baywatch coming in. I see you guys.
Oh, great. But there, all the set pieces in Con Air, I would say have, like, they just feel well done. Like, yeah. it's never too much. I would say the only time it gets to be almost too much is when they're landing on the strip in Las Vegas.
Oh my god. And they like jump into like, the fire truck and all that business.
Yeah. And like how many people died in that, like if Con Air were real, how many people just died?
Less than the Avengers, Tom.
Probably, yeah. yeah honestly.
No, I don't, it's such a silly movie. Everything about Con Air is so silly. And mm-hmm. and wonderful. And it does. I think it does hold up to that 90s like action thing. And because it's shot on 35mm, like it's shot on film and there's practical effects and it's a huge crew and huge set and they have a lot of money so they can do it right. As opposed to something like, I don't want to pick on it necessarily, but like I saw Expendables 2
yeah.
whenever I saw it. And that's also a Simon West movie. So,
yep.
okay. So
really?
I didn't even think of that as I was saying that. I love Con Air. Not a big fan of Expendables 2. My whole thing with that was like, if you just have cameras everywhere, then there's no real art to what you're doing. Because yeah. he's just putting up cameras and filming everybody
yeah,
at
every angle. Yeah.
Which like, you know, Ron Howard's been doing that lately and stuff. And it's like, I see what you're doing and I respect it as like a producer, but also, you know, Con Air is way cool because you had to choose where to put the camera and yeah. like what you're actually going to do with this.
There
stuff.
Was intention.
Yeah. You can't just like blow something up and shoot it at 9 different angles and be like, okay, we'll figure this out.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's not, you can do that. He does that. People do that.
People do that.
So I'm not one to say that you can't because fuck me, right?
When you get $75 million and Nicolas Cage on your bill.
Here's my question for you guys. I don't know if I'm going to be stepping sure. over you, Tom. Is where does this rank as like on the Cage scale?
Wow.
Where in the
on
Cage?
The Richter scale? Or wait, that's not.
That's the Andy.
That's the Andy Richter.
Andy Richter's wide range. Where does this land? But no, Nicolas Cage, you know, because it's such an over-the-top movie for him to be such a kind of
straight man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the best way to put it. He is the straight man in this. Everyone else is going like slightly insane. Even John Cusack plays sure. this like manic marshal, you know, this manic, you know, U.S. marshal just freaking out and like
the whole time.
Yeah. He's in a constant state of panic, which I love. I think John Cusack does a great job, but Nick Cage is surprisingly like into this.
Yeah.
So, he is really into it. So, I mean, he's done so many films. I think this is probably in his top 10, yeah. honestly. I think it really is that good. I think if you're going to watch a Nick Cage action movie, it's pretty much this or The Rock.
He's so... Or Face Off.
Oh, no. Ah,
although
now
that's
you put
whole,
me in a bind.
I mean, that's the another episode of The Cage.
That's yeah. another that edition
like,
of the
I have
Enter
so many things
cage.
To say about Face Off.
But, yeah. I would say I like Con Air more than Face Off.
Fair enough.
Is it better than The Rock?
I
That's
think
hard.
It's
actual Michael Bay.
I think I like that more. I think I like the ending of Con Air more than the ending of The Rock. to be
it's
honest.
It's such a... Really? Con Air's just an endlessly likable movie.
Yeah. I just think that the... I don't know. That scene where... That scene in The Rock where they're, like, fighting over the biohazard material, and then the people, you know, fly over, the planes fly over. I don't know. It's just... It's
you don't
not,
like it when he shoves it in his mouth, punches him in the face?
Yeah. No, that's great. Listen, it's not crashing a massive maximum security aircraft into the corner of the Hard Rock Hotel.
True words, man. True words.
20 fantastic years of Con Air. If you haven't seen Con Air, go see it. Like, it's actually streaming on Hulu right now.
Sure is.
Go watch it. If I don't think you even need a subscription necessarily. It just has commercial breaks. Oh. But if you have a subscription to Hulu, just go watch Con Air. It's incredibly fun. It is a great Nick Cage movie. And it kind of reminds people that Nick Cage was a blockbuster star. He was a big deal. He wasn't always on the USS Indianapolis, quality notwithstanding. Quality notwithstanding. Yeah, he wasn't always doing these, like, random roles. He was doing big Jerry Bruckheimer films that were pulling in $224 million. That's not bad.
That's just domestic, too, right?
I believe so. Yeah. $224 over a $75 million budget. Even if you double that. So you take your $75, make it, you know. It's just so incredible that a movie like this could be made.
It is such a good movie.
It's such a good movie. So, any final thoughts on Con Air? Con Air. Con Air, Con Air.
I just can't wait till I take the next ride on that red eye for the damned.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought that would be a cool, little tagline. Can you hear the wind?
Tie a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree. Daddy's coming home to his girls. Coming home forever.
Okay. Forever. There are a bunch of problematic parts in that movie too, but one that really stuck out to me is when we were kind of, I didn't want to bring it up then, but when he is seeing his wife at the bar and he like does that weird scene where he like pulls her close and he like starts talking to his daughter through her stomach.
Yeah.
And she like says, his wife says something and he's like, shh, can't you see him in the middle of a conversation here? And he's like, oh, what? You're going to become Miss Alabama? Well, that'll make your father awful proud. So he tells his wife to be quiet and hopes that his daughter is like a pageant queen in one sentence.
I can add to that because right after that, he's like, what does he say? He says, he gets into an altercation with those dudes before they leave again. And then his wife's like, yeah, that looks like the old Cameron. I thought you kind of took care of that. I thought the army would have changed that. And I'm like, you're fucking 42 years old. Like, when did you get into the army? And what did you change? What's to change? You're 35 years old. You have those problems with you. The army isn't going to change it after, like, okay.
And then it makes him a less sympathetic character, I would say, because then he's just like, oh, so, like, would he have been a criminal if he did not go into the military?
I think that's what it's supposed to say, is that it's not such a far stretch. I don't think that detail is super necessary whatsoever, but they do add it where it's like he was kind of – there's something up before the military, and then the military really straightened it out. But it's really only mentioned in that one line, so it's kind of like, is he a con? Is he a hero?
Is he
maybe
heir?
It's that fulcrum point again.
If
for the
character,
Con Air is
incredible.
So my opinion of the movie, I personally really enjoy it. I could understand why people watching it now that hadn't seen it would find, like I said, you know, some problems there.
Yeah.
But overall, it's a great movie. Could never be made today, and I'm so glad that it was made.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jake.
I mean, everything that you guys have already said, like, it's brilliant. It's a movie that's 20 years old, so if there are things that are not politically correct or we are a little bit more evolved now, good. Like, way to go, everybody.
Yeah,
like,
I'm glad that we have moved
past
that.
And own it, but then enjoy the movie for exactly what it is, because it's amazing. It's a great version of – it's a great example of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, for a movie like that, it will be all CG. So if you want to see some shit really get blown up that's not necessarily a Michael Bay movie, or it's close to a Michael Bay movie, Michael Bay does it too, but now it's all CG.
Now it's all the Transformers.
Transformers is like real explosions, I suppose. But
Oh, well. Well, there it is. Con Air, 20 years. Happy birthday. Thank you so much, everybody. This has been NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I have been your host, Tom Hush, and thank you again, as always, to my beautiful co-host, Connor Cornelius. Connor.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome. We'll go see Akira sometime. All right. You can catch us every single Monday on WGN Plus, but also development. You can listen to us on iTunes. If you go to iTunes podcasts, you just search NoCo Cinema. It's going to pop up there, and you will never miss an episode. It's going to be there every single Monday. It'll you set it up to download right to your phone wherever you are. You could be in the car, at the bar, wherever you are, listen to NoCo Cinema. But however,
near or far.
But if you want to catch more of what's going on WGN Plus, there's so many great shows here. Sound Sessions is fantastic. We've got so many great shows. And I think you can also get regular WGN programming. If you want all of that, you can download the WGN Plus app. Just head to the App Store, search WGN Plus, and you can get all the episodes of No Coast there along with a bunch of other great programs. Again, this has been No Coast Cinema. Good morning, good evening, and good night.